live from Gateway Community College in New Haven. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse. We're here at Gateway to open up a brand new studio that we have in conjunction with Gateway Community College, Connecticut Public Radio, just down the hall from us all day long. It's a big celebration of radio on Valentine's Day, and we're very happy to be here with some of our very favorite panelists. We'll be telling you more about some of the other things that are happening later on in the day coming up, but let me introduce our Wheelhouse panelists. As always, Colin McEnroe is here. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WMPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky. And before we continue, I'd like to put you in a very dangerous situation and point out that today is three different things, and I want you to rank them in order of their importance to you.
Okay, sure. I can do
that. It's Ash Wednesday.
Ash Wednesday.
It's Valentine's Day.
Yep.
And it's pitchers and catchers report for spring training.
Yeah, I definitely pitchers and catchers report. I'm actually going to add a fourth one to that. Yeah. There's one that you didn't know about.
Yeah. Is it somebody's birthday today, too?
No. It might be somebody's birthday, but I went on Facebook this morning.
Yeah.
Colin, it's our friendiversary.
We have our friendiversary today.
Did you know that?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, so I actually got a little choked up. There's a picture of the day we had the press conference when you were first announced as coming to WNPR. That's the only picture we have together.
Yeah.
Literally. But I think that's probably number one.
Okay.
Then pitchers and catchers. And then the other two, I'll let somebody else sort out.
Yeah. Might be a conversation with Mrs. Dankosky later today, however.
She actually prefers Ash Wednesday to Valentine's Day. Also with us here is Kalila Brown-Dean. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Hello there, Professor. How are you?
I'm great. Good to be back, John.
It's very good to have you here. And also with us is Paul Bass. He's the editor of the New Haven Independent. He hosts his own talk show on WNHH, the fabulous little radio station based at the Independent. Paul, good to see you as well.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having us.
And you know, the last time, Colin, that we had this panel assembled all together in New Haven,
we were drunk.
Yeah, we were drunk. It was an event that we call the Wheelhouse Uncensored, and so we're going to have to try very hard not to say some of the things, especially you, Kalila, that we said that night.
I'm the good one.
We might get ourselves in trouble again. Well, let's start actually with something that we've been really plowing through with all of our panels over the course of the last couple of weeks, this now building race for governor, this weird little race for governor. And I'll start with you, Paul, because you've been talking to a lot of these people, having them sit down with you on your radio show. First, I'll just quiz you. How many candidates for governor are there right now, in your estimation?
Colin and I were debating this before we went on air, and I think, Colin, did we compromise at 25?
I think, yeah. I mean, as long as we don't have to name them, I think 25 is a good number.
Yeah.
So 25, how many of them have you sat down and interviewed?
We've had 11 so far. We got a couple more coming in, you know.
Excellent. And, so, I mean, what are you learning about these folks as you have them sit down?
That a lot of people think that just because they're rich and they made a lot of money in Fairfield County, they can run the state of Connecticut, which is really a bogus idea.
That's a bogus idea. So that's one thread of inquiry. What else are you finding out? I mean, are they saying anything about, you know, it, rich or not, are they saying anything about what they're going to do to help fix some of the problems that we have in the state?
There's a general consent. Everyone has this mythical table. Everyone says, well, what are you going to do about these pension obligations? What are you going to do about the ability to not count on income tax revenues anymore? You say that you don't like some of the conditions in the labor agreement. They all have this mythical table that they're going to be able to get everyone around. We're going to get everyone around the table, and I'm the guy or I'm the woman who knows how to do that.
It's not a mythical table. There's a table. There's an actual table in Hartford that they all sit around.
Really?
I'm quite sure.
Because everyone always talks, and I always say we want a round table, and they're always horizontal. You know, always square. They always got rough edges. But the reason I bring that up, John, is because I think that people always beat on Dan Malloy. But when you really press them, like I pressed Oz Griebel yesterday, and I pressed Mike Handler and some of these other people, Malloy has done the things that everybody says they're going to do. He got unions in when he first was elected, 2010. He went around the state when we first had what we thought was a budget crisis, which is nothing compared to today. He got unions to agree with what were billed as $1 billion in concessions. Now what it really turned out to was probably $600 million, $700 million, some was phony. And he got businesses to agree to tax hikes, XS 2011. And no other state in the country, when they were dealing with some stuff, got both sides to do that. Now, we turned out that was not going to solve the problem. It wasn't going to be enough because we've gradually depended on an income tax for our revenues, because when we first passed it in 1991, we believed this was going to be a stable, predictable revenue stream. And now the economy has changed, so we're heavily reliant on people in Fairfield County who work in finance, whose incomes change very widely from quarter to quarter.
Sure.
But so Malloy did it again. He got this agreement with the unions. He got a lot of concessions, done a lot of cutting. So when you really press them, what struck me is the people who get less attention have the more specific ideas.
Mm.
Like a guy like Jonathan Harris on the Democratic side. He you know, he ran the Consumer Protection Department. He was a state senator. He ran a town, West Hartford. He actually talked about, well, we haven't looked at forests yet. And in fact, we can get $20 million a year if we manage to get the Yukon people, forestry people in and manage that and sell lumber. Now, you know, not going to solve the problem, but he's actually thought about it. How did you actually get marijuana patients in? How do you actually run the government? On the Republican side, there's a guy, Mike Handler, who has worked as CFO and CEO in Stanford for Republican Democratic mayors, has actually sat with the police union, ridden their cars, and actually revisited at the table a budget. Now, these guys are not rising to the top.
Yeah.
But you got all these people self-funding campaigns or others who are so sure they can fix it. When you press Ned Lamont, you press Stephen Asker, these kind of people, Griebel, they don't really have a lot of specifics about what they would do different from Malloy.
Well, it's interesting, somewhat, Kalila, if indeed what Paul's saying is true, that the current governor, who served two terms, has done most of the things already that these people are planning to do, then what they can look forward to in a couple of years is a 24% approval rating.
Well, you know, and you can continue on another political path if that's your goal as well. But I think the real problem here is that running as I'm not Dan Malloy will only get you so far. It may get you a couple of campaign dollars, but this is already feeling like the Republican race for the 2016 presidential election, where you had a very large field, you had your varsity squad and your JV practice team that no one knew the names, no one knew the real specifics. And I think given our current state in Connecticut, that's not going to be enough for people to get above the fold. So the real question is, will people step aside, not just for the good of Connecticut, I'm not that naive to think that's why people run, but for the good of their party? And if not, what will that infighting look like? I expect this to be one of the most expensive gubernatorial races that we've seen in Connecticut in quite some time. And that's not necessarily a good thing.
Colin?
Well, yeah, I'll just say a couple of things. First of all, one thing that surprised me with the Jonathan Harris piece, but it doesn't surprise me the more that I think of it, is that he self-identified as, I think, a pragmatic progressive. Now, I've known Jonathan for a really long time, and I like Jonathan a lot. Like, if I had to spend a weekend in Wellfleet with any of these people, first of all, what a hellish proposal that is. But I would definitely pick Jonathan. He's actually really kind of a fun person. And
sounds like a really, really terrible kind of television show.
That could be a new reality show.
That would be like
a
reality show.
Weekend in Wellfleet.
Screaming into the Atlantic Ocean in the first episode. But Jonathan's actually, and he does have some pretty meaningful experience. He was, I think, a pretty effective mayor of West Hartford. I don't think of him as a progressive at all. I don't think he's ever really identified with any progressive policies or many progressive policies. But I think what you're going to see a lot of this among the Democrats during the primary season, and there's a bunch of different reasons, ranging from the Bernie insurrection to, at a smaller level, they all watched Dan Drew, who was supposedly a candidate of some substance, completely get destroyed in his own city. He got kicked off his own town committee because there was a genuine progressive insurrection that didn't really buy his progressive bona fides. So I think you're going to see people, now that people are scared that's going to happen to them. They're going to pose as or claim to be progressives. I think you'll see Lamont do that. I think you'll see Bicewicz do that. You see Jonathan do it already. I personally, having watched their political histories, don't particularly find that a persuasive claim by any of them. Bronin won't run that way. He's going to run towards the center, probably run against public employees unions a little bit more than the others. One thing that I'll say just numerically is, although it is a very crowded field, on the Democratic side, I'm starting to see the shape of it. I mean, basically, they're going to go into the convention. I think the big players, in terms of delegates, they need to get 15%, are going to be Lamont, Bicewicz, and Bronin, and maybe Harris, just because he's been around so long. One problem that he has, I just want to say, was he was running the Democratic State Central Committee when it had its biggest political scandal, and I think it's fair to call it a scandal, about the use of contractor funds paid into a federal account and then out into a state campaign. They faced ultimately what they called a settlement. They insist on calling it a settlement and not a fine. Whatever it is, it's $325,000. The next biggest fine ever levied by that agency, or settlement, was $20,000. So that'll give you a sense of the magnitude of that problem. Now, Jonathan's fingerprints aren't necessarily all over that problem, but I think, you know, if I were running against him as a primary opponent, I would probably bring that up a little bit. I think you can sort of see probably those three, Bronin, Bicewicz, Lamont, coming out of the convention with their 15% or more, maybe Jonathan, he's very well connected, and then they run a primary. The Republicans, I don't know what they're going to do. They're going to have to change their convention rules. They've already been talking a little bit about that. There's so many of them, and there really aren't a lot of alpha wolves. I don't know how they thin that pack out.
Well, I think, and you're right about everyone's calling, Bronin is calling himself progressive. He tried to sound all he left because of Bernie. But I think the word progressive really doesn't mean anything. Dita Bargava, who's this hedge fund person from Fairfield County, she says she's the new kind of progressive, which also involves busting unions. So, you know, it's kind of hard to figure that out. But also
that
the
that
word
would be a new kind of progressive.
But I think the 2016 election has changed how we use these words, progressive and independent. So you got Oz Grebel, who's running as a third party guy, trying to be Lowell Weicker without the name recognition, even though his name Oz is easy to remember. But he's a former Republican running with a Democrat, Monty Frank, from Newtown, and they're running as independents. And before the 2016 election, the theory in politics was always that in primaries you run to your left or your right, depending on your party, but most people are in the middle. And I think 2016 kind of exploded that a little bit, because you had all these people who were for both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And they were looking, and now in Connecticut, when more than 800,000 people are registered as unaffiliated, the biggest voting block, almost twice as much as the number of registered Republicans. What does it mean? So Grebel and Monty Frank were saying yesterday, when I was talking to them, that they think that they're just like Connecticut, they're in the center. I said, was that really what we learned from the election, you know? And they said, well, it is, because we're free to say what we really think, and the reason people responded to Trump, the reason they responded to Sanders is they felt they believed what they said, and that most politicians don't.
But that, Kalilah, it might not necessarily show that they've learned anything from the last election, but the last election isn't the entire history of American politics. And there's a reason why there's 800,000 unaffiliateds in Connecticut and so many unaffiliated voters around the nation. I mean, where do you see those voters going as we head into these midterm elections, certainly into this governor's race? Because many people are really looking for a sensible middle.
So I think we have to, one, see 2016 as an outlier, because it was in so many ways. But I think the real concern is that with all of the discussion about the midterm elections, this gubernatorial election, we have to realize that turnout is always markedly lower in these down races. And I'm not convinced that what's going on in Washington right now, whether it's the White House or Congress or what we're seeing at the state level, will mobilize large numbers of people. What we should be looking at as well is what's happening in our cities, because that will have an impact on whether young people turn out. So, you know, millennial voters have a very different view of what it means to be a progressive as opposed to others who now want to claim this mantle. But also for the very large numbers of Black and Latinx voters in this state who don't align with either party really, because they feel like both parties have sold them out. And if I register as an independent, I'm automatically cut out of the primary process. This would be an opportunity for us to really talk about electoral reform if our goal is more participation. And I don't think that's the case, because more participation means I now have to be accountable to the people who are putting me in office.
Does that mean opening primaries? Remember Weicker and DeMoore tried to open the primaries for the Republican Party. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
So I will say that Lowell Weicker was my professor when I was an undergraduate at the University of Virginia. So I've been hearing this for quite some time. I won't say what year I graduated. But I think that given the numbers in Connecticut, and we heard in the governor's speech last week about increasing civic engagement and participation, opening the primaries is one way of doing that. I understand there are all kinds of problems, but it will be something that both political parties and really the electorate overall will have to consider.
Does that ever happen here, Colin?
That there were open primaries?
Well, yeah.
Did they actually get it open? Did DeMoore and Weicker succeed in doing that for
a
while? I feel like that happened.
That might have then shut
down. I don't know the answer
to
that. I mean, one way to think about this, okay, so to set up registration as a ratio, it goes something like this, 8-7-4, unaffiliated to Democrat to Republican. It's about that. I haven't looked at the rolls lately, but it's probably something like that. So the unaffiliated voters are the biggest group, 8, then 7 Democrats, 4 Republicans. So it's really in the Republicans' interest to a certain degree to do something like open primaries. You just pull a lot more people in and get them engaged. The problem is that you feel like you lose control of the process. You don't get to nominate. If you're sort of a red meat Republican, which I suppose is kind of the opposite of a progressive, you don't necessarily want a whole bunch of people waltzing in there who don't share your values and voting in your primaries, and that's why they don't do it. I think in this case, they're less likely to do it because it's such an incredibly confusing picture already, you know, that to throw that in there, you know, who knows who would, their nominee could be Paul or something, you know.
Well, I mean, I think that the Moore-Weicker theory was that's the way you win general elections is you'll have an election. But the counter theory is that they can actually, the other side can kind of go into your primaries and try, there were always those fears in 2016, they go in to try to throw it to the weakest candidate.
But before we break and before we get off this topic, Paul had mentioned that Jonathan Harris has some ideas. I mean, maybe we sell some forest land, right? Not? There's a lot of trees. We can get rid of trees.
He didn't say forest. He said clear cut and get so to help the other trees grow, and then you sell the lumber. He thought you can get $20, $30 million a year from that, going to the lumber business.
He's also getting his picture on the Brawny paper towel wrapper. Which is, I think that's good product placement.
Well here's another idea. Ready? So Peter Lumage, a Fairfield Republican, he's calling for all sorts of cuts to state agencies. He says he would immediately put the governor's mansion up for sale. And we have another Democrat, Mark Stewart, says we're going to rent the historic home out for $200 a night on Airbnb. I don't know if these are big money makers as much as the Brawny.
Will that be regulated?
Will that be regulated?
That's the question.
I know. I don't know, Colin. I mean, when people start talking about getting rid of the governor's mansion, are we at the point right now that we want to sell off a state asset as important potentially as the governor's mansion?
Well, if Peter Lumage thinks he can get a lot of money for the governor's mansion in this particular real estate market, he shouldn't be put in charge of any kind of fiscal policy. But I'll take this occasion to say this. Governors have used the governor's mansion in various ways. And so for John Rowland, it was just like another money pot that you could like pay stuff in. And, you know, there was that sort of foundation where you could just, it was another way to get money sort of to him. Jody Rell hardly ever stayed there. Dan Malloy, I think more than any governor of my lifetime, has made this a public place. It is available to just about anybody who wants it, any kind of nonprofit, any kind of charity that wants to do some, you know, wrap-up party for a big fundraiser. And he's at those things a lot. That's partly because he has no life. But, like, he'll be there, you know. Mean. And so I happen to live not too far from the governor's mansion, so I'm keenly aware because the streets are crowded with cars. And it is, I mean, talk about civic engagement. I think for somebody who, like, volunteered for an MS walk or something, and then they get to go to the governor's mansion. That's kind of exciting for people until they've actually been
there. I think
there.
You're being sentimental. I think the real problem with selling the governor's mansion is the one-time revenue, and you don't solve a budget problem with the one-time revenue. I mean, Oz Greenbill's idea is that you sell state office buildings in Hartford to developers and sell leaseback 30-year leases so that they go on the tax rolls.
There's so that much empty office idea. Space in Hartford right now. I just the idea that there's a market for office
You have the tenant guaranteed, so where the FOI office is or the attorney general. You sell it to a I don't like this necessarily, but I'm just saying it was interesting. Unlike a one-time revenue where you sell the mansion, his idea was that every office building that already has a tenant, the state government, gets sold to a private developer with a 30-year lease to the state agency. And he says that enables the tax base to grow in Hartford and the mill rate to come down.
All right.
Ask one question before break to the audience? Yeah. Is anyone here actually running for governor? Because we would not necessarily.
No, is anyone not?
We have a microphone.
Just show hands.
A couple people have just jumped into the race right now. We're talking
Also, my other quick question is, we have to decide when we talk about turnout in 2018, are we going to count Russian votes or not as turnout? So.
We'll try to answer that when we come back. Paul Bass is editor of the New Haven Independent. Of course, you just heard from Colin McEnroe. Kalila Brown, Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. When we come back, we're going to talk about cuts to the social safety net and also a plan to help, I don't know, maybe make some more money for the state. Yes, it's a casino, and there's some interesting ideas on that. We'll be talking casinos and more coming up in the Wheelhouse right after this. Live from Gateway Community College in New Haven, Connecticut, this is The Wheelhouse. We're here in front of an enthusiastic audience. I'm John Tankowski with Colin McEnroe.
Host go Lions.
Go Lions, a host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Colin, your show is going to be from this very stage later on today. Tell us what you're doing.
What we're doing there are various reasons why we're doing this, but partly just to make life even more confusing. We're taking the Friday show that we usually do, a cultural roundtable we call The Nose, and we will be on this stage having it on a Wednesday. And we'll be talking a little bit about the Obama portraits, which we may also get to here. And the terrible Cloverfield movie on Netflix, and the transition of Omarosa from... Actually, I don't think she's made any transition at all. I think basically the last 10 years have been just of a piece, but...
Is she in the Cloverfield movie?
I I don't know how they missed her because she'd fit.
So that's coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock, the Colin McEnroe Show live. It's a special edition of The Nose from right here at Gateway Community College. We are celebrating throughout the course of this day a brand new facility that's in partnership with Gateway. It's WMPR Connecticut Public Radio's brand new home. We're going to be giving tours throughout the day. I've also got an event coming up at 2:30. I'll be sitting down and talking with Jeff Cohen and Ryan Karen King, who've been back from two recent reporting trips to Puerto Rico. We've been covering the aftermath of Hurricane Maria and how this is a local issue for us as well, because we have such a dense population of Puerto Ricans here in the state. We're trying to track how that recovery is going for people here and also people on the island. We'll be talking about that reporting project coming up live on stage at 2:30 this afternoon if you want to stop by. We were talking about the governor's race off the top. I know, Kalila, you want to talk about something that you've been reading about in the New Haven Independent and something that we probably should spend a little bit more time on. Nonprofits plead with lawmakers to stop big budget cuts. And a lot of local nonprofits are saying, look, we need to figure out a way to stop this bloodletting because it's really hurting people downstream.
Right, and I think it's easy to say we need to make cuts, and we certainly do. But I think there has to be a realistic conversation about what gets lost when you have community-based programs and agencies that deliver basic things like energy assistance. And the idea that here in the Northeast, people don't have the funds to pay for home heating, and that kind of support will go away. So we've heard some of that in President Trump's budget proposal, slashing that energy assistance, looking at the local level support for mental health services, addiction services, special needs residents, opioid addiction. I think that if we make those cuts to those agencies and we undermine those service delivery and the important relationships they have, we will not only create a public health crisis, but there will also be a public safety crisis. And so I think it has to be so much more nuanced than just cut funds. What is going to happen in return? So our idea that we're going to address a problem in one area is actually creating newer problems and problems that I don't think the private sector is ready to address.
Paul, how is this affecting people here in New Haven?
Well, we saw a great example of what Claude was talking about on Friday. Suddenly, with no notice, New Haven's Community Action Agency closed its doors and people had nowhere to go for emergency heat. And this was a long-running problem, and I won't go into all the weeds here. You can read about it in The Independent. But it's really what Kalila was talking about. The state has cut back on a bunch of things, and one of them included one of their key revenue streams, and they had to pay back an old debt to another social service agency. They were pitted against each other. One went to a bank and got a warrant. A court got a warrant and drained the other one's bank account. But the deeper problem, and Mayor Tony Harper's talking about this as they got the place partly reopened, is that the state is actually looking to not-for-profits to pick up the load as they cut their own budget. But if that's just going to be an excuse to just pay less by paying people less, you don't get as people working at the group homes who really have the experience to do that, you're going to have more situations like this where the agencies can't function. They get paid 4 months late because of the budget problems. And I think that you're going to see in the budget debate coming up this year and in the governor's race the suggestion that not-for-profits be contracted with, at the same time we're cutting them in other ways and paying them less to do the job. And I think Kalila's right that we actually have to commit as a state to take care of people, and that otherwise it actually hurts our bottom line as well as our soul.
Colin?
I think you have sort of a three-pronged attack on this problem. One of them is the one that Kalila and Paul have so articulately described. Then it's coming at the federal level. There are cutbacks. There are bizarre proposals. Today's bizarre proposal du jour is to replace SNAP with this food box system, which Mulvaney hilariously compares to Blue Apron. I don't think it's going to be very much like Blue Apron. It's a situation which would actually hurt a lot of different people, not only the poor people who receive food assistance, but the people who are going to really kick about this are going to be grocery stores and grocery chains. They depend on a certain amount of traffic through that program, farmers markets too, and the whole idea is to sort of make it on a contract basis, and you'd get canned meat and canned vegetables. You wouldn't be able to get any fresh. It's just a terrible idea. It's an example of some of the terrible ideas that will come down the pipe at the federal level. And then the third prong of this trident is the one that I've mentioned in the past. It's a ticking time bomb that I think people have not reckoned with, although Giancarlo Cassa, who's the head of the nonprofits here and formerly of the Malloy administration, would be happy to tell you about it. And it's the problem of the tax bill that was just passed, which as you push people into non-itemization, as you double the standard deduction and pull people out of the itemization process, they no longer are getting a charitable deduction from their taxes. Their incentive to give to nonprofits drops significantly. And I think some of these agencies that depend also on donations in addition to any state contract they have or anything like that may be facing some really hard times. It's hard to calculate what the bullet effect of that tax reform is going to be. But there's no question that it will have an effect, and it might be a pretty big one.
Yeah, and Kalila, you mentioned potential cuts coming to federal assistance for heating, especially people in the Northeast. This is a big deal. I'll just say that this is somewhat compounded by some of the efforts at the state level to fill their own coffers. Our own Patrick Scahill has been reporting on the fact that energy efficiency funds, which have long helped people save money on their electric and heating bills, those have been raided in this last state budget, meaning it's a lot harder for people to go out and figure out ways to keep their houses energy efficient and get help to do that. It really hits low-income people harder because there's a little bit more in the pot for people who have gas heat, a little bit less for people who have oil heat. And Kalila, is also costing people jobs. There's a burgeoning economy around doing weatherization and putting solar panels on houses that is being sunk in part by what's happening at the federal level and also what's happening now at the state level.
And it's all this sort of idea of let's do something, but what we're doing clearly is not working. And if you think about the incentive to be a homeowner in a place like Connecticut, where you know that you're going to have these heating or energy assistance bills, many people say it's not even worth it for me to own a home with all of these issues about taxing and deductions and itemizations. So if we don't have that kind of revenue stream with people who are homeowners, it's going to affect so much of what we do in this state. And I think, you know, Colin's point about charitable donations, the ability to deliver those services, there are certain things that I think are and should be public functions. And privatizing that will not be a long-term solution.
Okay, a quick thought, Paul?
I was going to say the bottom line is we don't want to pay anymore for government. So that's why if we're racing about having to raid the green fund to pay for something else, it's because this whole idea, the Republican government has changed the conversation since Reagan that we just don't pay for things. It's going to be a million points of life with charity to do government functions. And in this state, they don't believe they could ever raise taxes on anything or any levy, or you can't run for office, but then you can't fund the government.
Okay, well, let's look at another way that people are trying to fund the government, and I'm reading in the New Haven Independent, New Haven's labor unions flexed their political muscle to back MGM Resort's proposed casino in Bridgeport. At a rally February 6th at Unite Here's Hall, three mayors, four state legislators, two of them Republicans, one gubernatorial hopeful, nine alders, and a crew of workers from other MGM properties spoke about the jobs that a resort casino could bring to the region. Labor getting behind a Bridgeport casino deal, Paul?
Yeah, do you remember the last Bridgeport casino? There was the same mayor, Mayor Ganim, and Donald Trump. And that's when Ganim went to jail. But anyway, that was the 90s, and we're not in the 90s anymore. So they want to build, they claim they want to build a big casino in Bridgeport. And the reason, the most politically powerful union is Unite Here in this part of the state, because they turn out the vote better than anybody, and they basically elected Dan Malloy twice. And they have a lot of, they have a lot of casinos in Las Vegas where they represent the workers, and they have very good relationships with the companies, including MGM. So they're tight with MGM. So MGM wants to build in Bridgeport, but that's going to mean changing state law and undoing permission we gave a Native American tribe to build in East Windsor. Now, there are two things that are really shady about this. I know anytime you talk about casinos,
there's just
shady.
Two.
No, there are a lot. The first two things that are shady about this is MGM just built a casino in Springfield, Mass. So it's a race to the bottom who can get the most gambling addicts to try to keep your government afloat for 3 years and have the casinos run off with the money. They want to stop the tribe from building there. But if we undo our agreement with the tribe, we lose $200 million a year in slot revenue. And plus, I would argue we're undoing another treaty we had, but that's another thing people don't seem to talk about. But it, so we don't even know if they really want to build in Bridgeport or if they just want to knock off, get a law passed to knock off the one in Windsor. But secondly, the question is it good for the society in general to have a lot of your revenue dependent on people being addicted to gambling? And how many years will you be able to get all that revenue until another casino is built?
That chip has sailed.
Yeah.
And I did say chip instead of ship. The one thing that I would just say about all this is, I mean, first of all, it's a terrible idea. I'd like to say that first. But, I mean, these promises of jobs are written on the wind. Whatever numbers that they put, every time they put out the numbers, I think, well, what happens when there's the next round of casino expansion, probably coming from the greater New York City area? What happens then? What happens to all these jobs that you're promising us? I mean, the handle keeps going down. So Paul referenced the deal that the Weicker administration initially made that in return for guaranteeing exclusivity to the tribes, there's this big pot of money that comes to the state from video slots. The problem is, as you also implied, that money, is it $200 million now? I mean, it's dropping by tens of millions of dollars in fiscal cycles. So this is not a handle that's going to grow. It's going to shrink. That's what they're doing all over the country. There's more competition. And so whatever jobs numbers they put out, I think, are very misleading. I don't think those jobs are anything close to permanent jobs.
Kalila?
Well, I think it also works against what we already know are the key challenges in our state. So on the one hand, we're complaining about infrastructure and our sort of crumbling infrastructure, and how do we need to address this? How are we going to address the transportation issue? So if it's being sold as this is going to be good for New Haven, how are people going to get to those jobs? All of the concerns about public transportation and increased costs. But we just finished talking about drawing down agencies and the delivery of services. So for everyone who's saying, well, it'll be okay because we have services to help people with gambling addictions, who's providing those services? And if those agencies that provide that, who are there to protect the most vulnerable in our state, aren't able to deliver the services because they're either broke or they've had to merge or shut down, then we've created another problem. And I see this as all being nested, that when we play to the weakness with the idea that we can monetize that vulnerability, it's not a sustainable plan for economic development in our state.
All right. Well, let's move on to another topic where maybe there's also not a sustainable plan. Costs, I'm reading this from the Hartford Current. This is a quite an eye-opener. Costs associated with UConn's decision to fire former football coach Bob Diaco totaled more than $5.3 million, nearly $2 million more than the $3.4 million buyout that his contract called for. That's according to the UConn Athletics Department's 2017 financial statement and other documents provided to the Current. So, Colin, when we have a football coach of a program that has traditionally, in the last several years, not been very good, you're going to pay him a lot of money, you're going to sign him to an extension, and then you're going to let him go, you'd think, well, that's going to cost some money. How does it end up costing nearly $2 million more than even what you're contracted to pay the guy now that you have to pay another football coach to take his job?
Well, some of that is they fired his whole understaff, too. So some
which
of
tends to happen.
Yeah, which tends to happen. And so anything that's guaranteed in their deals, including quite a bit of benefits, is larded into the severance. There's also, believe it or not, a prorated retention bonus that Diaco will get, I think, $167,000 out of. And it kind of adds up at a certain point. I would say that, I mean, this, you know, inglorious tradition stretches on, because Diaco, yeah, he was fired. He's been replaced by Randy Edsall, who, to the best of my knowledge, still has not signed a contract.
That is correct.
Yeah, he has a thing that's kind of like Rob Porter's security clearance or something. It's like this letter. And the reason he has not signed a contract is because he's essentially in protracted negotiation/litigation with the state over what amounts to just naked nepotism, his desire to hire his son as part of the football coaching staff. And so the one thing that I would say is, if I were in the state legislature right now, which fortunately for everybody, I'm not, I would ask OLR or somebody, Office of Legislative Research, just to do a paper for me on what it would cost. What would be the effect? What if you shut down this Division I football program? Like, what would happen? What are the numbers? I'm not saying it's a great idea. I'm not saying it's a bad idea. At the Division III level, there's been a kind of recrudescence of football. Like, Wesleyan is much more interested in its football now. The University of Chicago brought back football, which they haven't had in decades, and it's seen maybe at that level, where the numbers are much smaller, as a way of energizing your alumni base, and maybe it does that effectively at the UConn level. But I would really love to look at this, like what would happen if we just shut the whole thing down? How much money would we lose? How much money would we get back? I'm not saying that there's public will to do it. I'd just like to know the numbers.
And Kalilah, you know, you teach at a school that is a small school that is Division I in many, and no football. But you come from a few bigger football programs. You went to the Ohio State University and also the University of Virginia, smaller football program, but a big basketball program. And even the talk in a place like Columbus, Ohio, that let's take a closer look at whether or not football's a good deal for us, doesn't even really happen. No. But, I mean, how does this sit with you? Because there are some certainly intangible benefits to a high-quality football program for universities. It gets you an awful lot of recognition.
You get a lot of recognition and some really nice swag T-shirts, and, you know, every couple of months they throw some new incentives in. But I think about the fact that, you know, Johnny Taylor had this song, It's Cheaper to Keep Her. And we look at these coaches, that makes it clear. For many of them, it's cheaper to keep them than to clear out their staff. But I'm looking at the reality that I have students who are not sure whether they will be able to return to college next semester because of the increasing cost. We've seen an increase in the number of adjuncts who are paid a paltry amount. And we're having this discussion. It's sort of a disgusting discussion to have about the millions of dollars that we pay out to coaches with losing programs. What does it mean that we're having a discussion about whether to pay student athletes? And at a place like UConn, that will necessarily mean that the women's basketball players who have a stellar record would be compensated less than their counterparts on the football team. So I think that if we're really serious about the economic implications of this, but also what it means for a community, and to put that kind of money into that program, says a lot about our real priorities. Everyone loves to have a big parade after they win the Super Bowl. UConn's not going to win the national championship anytime soon.
Yeah, and Philadelphia has been waiting for a long time for that parade.
Philadelphia needed a win. They needed a win. It took a couple of decades, but they needed the win.
I don't know, Paul, your view from New Haven on all this, because, I mean, in some ways the idea of UConn football isn't really a statewide phenomenon, and it had a little bit of a heyday a couple of years ago, and now it's fallen sort of into disrepair.
No, I mean, it's a sick conversation to be having, and I mean, we're in Gateway Community College, where supposedly we were going to be training the new workforce so we compete in the new economy through community colleges, and they just merged it. We built this new building, but we just merged this with the Bridgeport campus. Now they're talking about merging all the community colleges in the state because there's no money. I mean, it's just sick.
But before we move from the sick sports conversation and take a break, Colin, one of the fun things we saw here is, so, and this is a very typical Dan Malloy thing, we hear from the brand new owner of the Carolina Hurricanes. They're, of course, the hockey team that left Hartford as the Hartford Whalers and went to go play as the Hurricanes in the Raleigh-Durham area. They won a Stanley Cup down there a few years ago. They don't necessarily do so well as far as attendance goes, but they got a new owner, very energized. One of the things he said that he wanted to do is maybe play some throwback games in Hartford Whalers sweaters, to actually wear the old Hartford Whalers gear for a Carolina throwback game. For Governor Malloy to step into this is very typical him. He says he sent a letter Friday to the new owner of the Hurricanes inviting the team to return home and play a regular season outdoor game at where? Rentschler Field in East Hartford.
Right. So first of all, I will not support this idea unless you are the PA announcer.
Oh, I've always wanted to do that.
Yeah, I know. I mean, John has several quirks. One of them is that he takes hockey seriously. I'll quickly say this about the Whalers. First of all, in terms of the psyche of the state, and this is closer to a statewide thing. I don't know how much New Haven penetration there is, but this whole thing is, you know, it's like those Japanese soldiers that they would find 15, 20 years after World War II still thought the war was going, and they're like on an island with five grenades or something. They're just people, I run into them all the time, who are still feverish about the Whalers. And the Whalers jersey still outsells actual active NHL franchise jerseys overall. It's a defunct franchise, and their merchandise is incredibly popular. Part of that is because of the excellent Peter Good logo.
Yes.
But so I guess as a kind of salve to these I think, clinically insane people who are still talking about the Whalers, it maybe would be a good idea. But I guess I would turn it back to you.
Yeah.
Do you think it's a good idea?
Well, here's the thing. I think that if we were able to bring back hockey full-time to Hartford with an ownership team, and I will say this isn't a pipe dream. There are ownership teams in America that have actually built their own arenas, and they've controlled the finances of those new arenas. You still have to work with the city or state to get some deals, but it's not publicly financed. If you could do something like that, hockey back in Hartford would be something that I think people would like an awful lot. But John, there's no chance that that will ever happen.
And John, they kept saying that in New Haven. We kept wooing new hockey teams in that kept going buses. We went one row down on what league they were in, and we blew up our Coliseum. I don't think that's how cities are reviving. I think these big, there are always a lot of public dollars that go in that never get back, and the company's profit. Well, what really built New Haven, we have a renaissance in New Haven, partly came from getting away from this idea of luring sports teams. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well,
if you could blow up the Coliseum every weekend,
that was a good idea.
People would be coming.
I hope we're going out of this segment with brass bananas.
From far and wide. This is The Wheelhouse. We're live from Gateway Community College in New Haven. It's the home of a brand new studio that WMPR Connecticut Public Radio has. We're going to be celebrating all day long on this Valentine's Day. Paul Bass is here. He's editor of the excellent New Haven Independent. Kalila Brown Dean is here. She's the excellent associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. And Colin McEnroe, host of the pretty darn good Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, which will also be live here today. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with more in The Wheelhouse. Live from Gateway Community College in downtown New Haven, Connecticut, this is The Wheelhouse.
Yeah.
We're here in front of an audience as we celebrate the brand new studio of Connecticut Public Radio in Gateway Community College. We've got a series of events going on all day long, including a live version of the Colin McEnroe Show this afternoon at 1 o'clock. He's got the Nose panelists down here in New Haven. Our panelists are our New Haven regulars, Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, and Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent. We've got some folks in the audience who want to ask a thing or two or say, hi there, what's your name?
Michael.
Hi, what's your question?
Much of what you talked about had to do with budget. So the question is, how do we get funds for the state that meets the needs of the state?
So you saved us the real easy question. Thank you. I appreciate that. So I don't know, let's go down the line. Paul, we need to find money to fill a state budget deficit. We need to make sure that we don't cut social services, as we've said, are being cut already because of the existing problem. We have to pay for long-term obligations, which we haven't even really budgeted for decades, which are just accruing like crazy over time. And then we want to do things like rebuild our roads. We want to invest in new ideas. We want to maybe even try to get some new business started here. So where do we start to find the money for this?
Even though I'm supposed to be a pundit and haven't answered everything,
yes.
I don't have an answer about the long-term pension obligations. There are a lot of different ideas about whether you stretch out the payments and whether that's going to cost us more. Denise Napier is arguing with Dan Malloy about that. We have someone in the room who knows a lot more than I do about this. But in the short term, I do think that we should be raising more revenue. I think that it should not be this allergy to ever talking about actually paying our share for the common good. I think we can legalize marijuana, recreation use of marijuana. I think we can put highway tolls up. Malloy's fine on the right track. I'm doing the $3 tire tax and the 7 cents gas tax increase. I think that even though $250 million is a lot of money, I think we definitely can do it without causing more pain that's going to cost us more in the long run by continuing to cut.
I'll just say quickly, we talk a lot about the gas tax. We've talked a ton about tolls, which there's a lot of conversation around. The gas tax, though, it's sort of like some of the other things that we've said before around casinos. There's a lot less money being spent on gas in America these days.
And
to put that into the budget, that's a
problem. That's not the long-term sustainable answer. I agree with that.
Kalila, how about you? Where do we find the money for this?
So if I had the answer, I'd run for governor. And clearly,
please,
I'm not.
Would you please run for governor?
It's not
a requirement that you have any answers, actually, as it turns out.
I'm not going to raise the number of candidates to
26. Haven't you been listening? They don't have no answers at all.
I am so naive. What can I say? This is not going to be a popular answer, but it is a realistic answer. I think that we have to look, as Paul Paul said, at increasing revenue streams. And if that means raising taxes, I think that's what has to be done in order for us to have the kind of vibrant state that we not just want, but that we need to figure out how we convince young people to stay here, to not just get educated here and leave, so that families have a real chance of passing on what they have earned and worked hard for to their families. And that's not some pie in the sky response, but it's about, again, protecting our public health, protecting our public safety, and looking at the long-term success of our state.
But what about this long-time argument that you do that and you put Connecticut at a competitive disadvantage? The people who pay the income tax right now are going to leave in droves.
See, that's such crock. I mean,
but that doesn't happen in droves. You know, we've had an issue with keeping businesses and corporations in the state. We have seen some population shifts, but, you know, it's not a mass exodus. If that were the case, people would be somewhere else right now. So I think about including people in the conversation, because not a lot of people have the kind of mobile wealth where they can pick up and move to another state. And the real thing that we have to address, this is not uniquely a Connecticut problem. This is a challenge for states across our nation, across the Northeast. That's where we need to start focusing.
Colin?
This has all, you know, become more problematic since somebody walked into this room who actually has to deal with these problems in a concrete way, and I'm just some idiot in a baseball hat sitting on a stage. But with that in mind, I do think one role that pundits maybe play is to get people to dream a little bit or think a little bit. The way that I like to think about this is that for my entire lifetime, this has been a way too complicated question. I go back to the Grasso administration and Tony Milano, I think, who was the budget director at that time. I've never really understood exactly how much revenue we have or how much things cost, because it's made very, very complicated. I would suggest it's a bad idea to do something like legalize marijuana just for the money. You legalize marijuana if you think it's a good idea, and then you get the money. But you don't do it to get money. Legalizing marijuana is a different kind of social policy and criminal justice policy change that you make for a different reason. And I think that the reason we're in that trap and in that cycle is that we'd rather be nibbled to death by ducks than take two bites from a lion. There, I get the mascot into the conversation.
Go Lions.
And what I mean by that is I would prefer, ultimately, even though I do support the tolls idea, I would prefer that we have a graduated income tax and a sales tax and not much else. I think it makes the revenue stream a lot clearer. Maybe it's okay if gas is cheaper in Connecticut. I think all these little things, you know, we're going to raise the cigarette tax a little bit. We're going to raise this. We're going to turn up this dial, and turn down that dial. I think it leads to cloudy budget making. I'd rather simplify it, really get it down to maybe two taxes, figure out what government really costs. What does it cost to have the government that we really think is the style of life and the style of services that a state like Connecticut should deliver, and then pay for it two ways?
We only have a couple minutes left, so we will jettison some of the big national issues that I'm sure you'll be hearing a lot about and On Point and other national programs. And I want to ask Kalila about another national issue that you've been writing about a little bit, and I know Colin might mention on the nose this afternoon. What do you think of the new portraits of Barack and Michelle Obama, these official portraits that are out of the style that most presidential portraits have been made in the past? Of course, this is a president and first lady who indeed are different in so many ways than the presidents and first ladies of the past.
So we had a pretty raging debate about this on social media a couple of days ago when this first came out. I think that it is at once an act of rebellion and self-affirmation for these portraits to be in the National Gallery that do not look like anything else that is there. And I think that fits with the Obama family, that for so long they've been treated as outsiders. It was a way for them to embrace that status and to highlight two amazing young artists that many Americans had never heard of, but you will know who Kehinde Wiley is now. That said, it is not my favorite portrait of the First Lady. I see her as this beautiful brown-skinned woman who I wanted to see that in perpetuity in the portrait gallery. But the intricate details of those portraits and what they represent for the importance of quilts within African-American cultures and communities, I think it says something about their connection to the American people and their vision of America that is much more inclusive than it's ever been.
A thought, Paul, very quickly?
I'm just going to defer to Colin.
Defer to Colin. You'll be talking about this afternoon, Colin.
Right. I will be punished if I don't say that the Wiley was first exhibited at Real Artways in Hartford. I think that was the very first exhibit of Wiley's work. I would just quickly say that, you know, it's exciting to see a style of African-American art that's really been growing for a long time, you know, and really there was the kind of post-war generation of African-American painters, Romare Bearden, Jacob Lawrence, my old and departed friend Benny Andrews, who combined elements of the academy with elements of what we now call outsider art. And I actually love the Michelle Obama portrait. I love the kind of Mondrian kind of fusion with quilt making, and it is so different, but I think it's different in a really exciting way.
Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR Connecticut Public Radio. He'll be here this afternoon at 1 o'clock live in front of an audience at Gateway Community College. Also, Kalilah Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, Paul Bass from the Great New Haven Independent. Thanks to Katie Talarski, Scott Breedy, Lydia Brown, Carmen Baskoff, Garnett McLaughlin, TJ Coppola, Joe Koss, and everyone at Gateway Community College for making our debut here on stage very successful. And thank you to the audience for being here. Give yourself a round of applause. This is The Wheelhouse.